Hello, welcome to episode number 347 of the Appalug Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. This show is actually brought to you in part by BetterHelp. Go get convenient, safe, and secure online counseling today. You can connect with a therapist of your choosing in minutes by taking the online survey. Use the code word APPALUG to get 7 days for free when you go to betterhelp.com/APPALUG. If you want to support my work on a monthly basis, go check out my Patreon. Go to patreon.com/APPALUG. You can pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees. And you can cancel anytime. Go buy a t-shirt from appalug.ca/shop. If you're on Apple iTunes, don't forget to subscribe, rate and review the show. Give it 5 stars, please. Like and share on Facebook by going to facebook.com/appalugpod. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at simonhead666. And don't forget Spotify. Spotify is a neat way. It's a new thing I've been trying out for the past year or so. I only have about 50 or 60 episodes on there already because I have to go back and I have to re-upload everything. It's a mess. Anyways, check out Spotify and tell your friends. Tell your friends. Today on the show, I have Rob Good from The Goods. Rob Good is a veteran of the Oakland Underground. That's Oakland. That's in the United States, just so you know. And he's played in many, many bands. And this is one of the only real episodes of the podcast where I actually played every single song from the EP. And it's a great record. If you like bands like Cheap Trick, Mott the Hoople, all that kind of old 70s, cool, awesome glam stuff, check this out and you'll love it. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Good from The Goods on the Appalug Podcast.
Yeah, let's kick it off. I don't quite know what to expect, but I'm ready to take the plunge.
Are you a podcast host or guest? Are you used to being a guest on podcasts?
I am not used to being a guest on anything.
Oh my gosh! Well, this is there's no formed questions. It's just we have a big old chat and a natter, and people get to know who you are. They already know you do good music, so they might as well know who you are as a person. That's My opinion about musicians, I like them as people, I like their music more. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah, that sounds cool. And just to let you know, I'm not sure how long this usually takes, but I have until about six, or I have about an hour.
Oh, okay, perfect. Yeah, it's about 40, 45 minutes. So.
Okay,
you know. Perfect. It goes longer if people are like getting nattery, but I mean, we're all good. If we're on a time, we're on a time. So, So you're no stranger to music. You've been playing music your whole life.
I have been. I started playing guitar when I was around 10 or 11 years old and kind of just, you know, learned a couple chords and just went and started a band, essentially.
It's the best way to do it. So no formal like training and just a few lessons here and there, or?
Yeah, not really. A few lessons here and there. I think when you start playing the guitar specifically, you know, lessons are usually pretty loose and informal. It's usually you find somebody to just sort of teach you songs, right?
Yeah.
And then as soon as you figure out that like all the songs you like have pretty much the same chords, it's like, oh, well, screw lessons. I'll just go, I'll just go start writing my own stuff. And then later, you know, over the years, I kind of went back and picked up a little bit more, you know, theory along the way, but I don't read charts or anything, and
I've just started a band that do that, like these guys, just horn guys come up just like, and they just play it like no problem. I'm like, how do you do that? It's wizardry. Even though I took classical piano, and I can read and I have theory, I just don't understand and have that confidence. I have to learn it, like I have to learn the music or I'm sunk.
Yeah, I'm envious of people who can do that, especially because, you know, like I'll sit in with other bands from time to time. And when you don't have that theory knowledge or, you know, the knowledge of, musical notation and stuff, sometimes I'm just like, I wish I could just write this down. and then read it. But I have to make weird sort of esoteric notes when I'm trying to learn a new song or something.
Yeah.
The notes on a staff don't mean anything.
My buddy John used to be the bass player in a band called the Weaker Thans. He has this knack of knowing what chords go from where to where. He can just sit on a stage. They'll start playing chords, and he's like, well, it's either going to go here or here. Like, he's explained it to me, but it's like, that's sort of like wizardry stuff. It's like, it's either going to go to this note or this note, whatever chord it is. And that's how he can, you know, he played bass in a band for me, like in my band, just for like two or three shows because we needed a bass player. And he came down to the basement and just started playing.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
He has an extrasensory sort of thing.
He's like a Wordle, you know, like Wordle where it's like a certain amount of...
Right.
It only goes a specific way. Yeah, he's definitely that type of guy. So you grew up... Did you grow up sort of in the northern part of California, or have you always been in Oakland?
I've always been in the Bay Area,
In
the greater sort of eastern part of the Bay Area. I've been in Oakland for many years. Many would consider Oakland northern California, even though there's a lot of California north of Oakland.
Yeah, I was trying to put all that together, you know.
Yeah, you know... There's a lot of sort of more rural stuff as you go further north, but, you know, as it's distinguished from Southern California, which is like, you know, Los Angeles, San Diego, and that, in that end, we're technically considered Northern California, even though we're right in the middle, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like, I know there's a huge big, like I-5 between Sacramento and whatever, the Grapevine. That's just like the straight line that just, that's how you get to LA from northern part of California, right?
It's a very long, boring drive. There's a nicer way to get there. You can down
the Pacific Coast Highway.
And it's much nicer, but 5 is the straight shot, but you're stuck in the Central Valley, which is, you know, not a whole lot to look at on that drive.
Nope. I did that drive once down to Malibu from Santa Cruz. And I did the Pacific Coast Highway, and it was because we had a day off, and it takes longer, but it's a beautiful drive. There's an amazing, if you're into trains, there's a great train line that goes up all the way up to I think it's Portland or Seattle in that area.
Oh, cool.
And it follows the coast all the way up. And, you know,
that's pretty incredible. I'm not into trains.
As you get older, you start getting into trains more.
Why is that?
I don't know, because I'm totally into them. I'm like, I want to take the California Zephyr. I've already taken some high speed. I've taken some high speed trains in Europe, but I want to do train trips. And my wife's not there yet, but I'm totally there. I might just do it by myself.
Yeah, that'd be great. Hey, go for it. Our bass player, he insists that the train. He has family out in the Tahoe area, and he always takes the train from the Bay Area out to Tahoe, and it's great.
Oh yeah, because are you doing Rockies at that point? I guess you are doing Rocky Mountains.
It's like, yeah, it's like Tahoe is like sort of smack dab in the middle of the Sierra Nevadas, not the Rockies, but yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's you know, just right out the other side. You're in Nevada, but you're still in the mountains in the Tahoe area.
I did that drive once from Sacramento over the mountains towards Reno. And I got stuck in a snowstorm like you would not believe. Like, the world was ending. We're going to have to look like I'm looking at the people driving. Like, you look tasty. I could probably eat you if we're, like, stuck.
It happened sometime.
It was really bad. And I'm like, you know, as a stupid Canadian, you're like, well, of course, California is always warm. Why are we worried about snow?
You guys know the snow better than we do.
I know, but it's there. You have it, too. It's all there, and it's close to where palm trees are. That's the confusing part for me.
That's the confusing part. Well, you know, the palms aren't native. They brought those in to fool everybody.
Oh, okay. Bummer. So other bands you played in, I always talk to people who start a new project, and it's always kind of more fun to get off the ground and easier to get off the ground because you've done it before. Was it a case? That's a case in this type of situation, right?
I don't know so much. Actually, this was felt kind of tough to get off the ground only because I haven't, it'd been a long time since I'd been the songwriter in a band. Mm-hmm. I've kind of been a sideman for a while, now playing either bass or guitar and lots of backing vocals and maybe sort of assisting on some songwriting stuff. But I hadn't had a brainchild of my own for a while. So when Paul, the drummer, and I kind of got together and started playing, not only were we coming out of the quarantine, so we hadn't seen anybody, let alone played with anybody for, you know, going on 2 years at that point. And we were just, you know, our chops were kind of rusty. Just figuring out kind of like how to play together and what we wanted to do and what songs we liked and didn't like. It was a whole process. And we wrote almost an entire album's worth of songs and then, you know, scrapped the whole thing and kind of started over again.
That happens.
Yeah. And so it was kind of a slow gestating thing. And, you know, it took us a while to, you know, find a bass player that really, you know, was sort of simpatico with what we were doing and get that worked in. So I don't know. This one was tough. I mean, I guess, you know, with experience, you kind of like, you know how to navigate those waters a little better, but, you know, everything kind of has to happen in its own time, you know, and this kind of felt like a long one. I think it was, you know, almost a year of just kind of workshopping before we started recording the EP.
Yeah.
And then the recording process was, you know, even though it was only a handful of songs, like we were building out our own studio and kind of like, you know, learning our own kind of process as we went along. So there was a lot of, you know, starting and stopping and taking a step back and being like, you know, do we like this? Let's, you know, kind of retool this and that. So, yeah, I don't know. It felt slow to me.
Well, you know, we don't need to mention the P word, but that definitely probably put the wrench on a bit of it. The whole idea, it's tough. It was tough to, you know, to do anything. It's tough to go grocery shopping.
It's tough to do anything. Yeah. But actually, I mean, not that it was a good thing, but I don't know if I would have started writing songs again, if not for that time in isolation.
Yeah.
You know, it just, there's a lot of, there was nothing but time to kind of, you know, sort of reflect and, sort of find oneself, I guess. So, you know, it had been years and years and years since I felt like I had anything that I wanted to write about. And I just, you know, out of just boredom or loneliness or whatever, just kind of all of a sudden discovered that I really, really liked it. And it was a lot of fun and really gratifying to put songs together again and sing in my own voice. And so, I don't know, without that time, that sort of forced isolation, who knows, you know?
Right. Well, at least you didn't mention it. You didn't mention it in the songs, did you? You didn't. Good.
I don't think we have any.
To it, but I mean, yeah, you can't mention it. It's like, you know, it's like, you can't put that in your words.
I'd
switch off.
It's too soon. It's
on the nose, as they say.
Yeah.
On the nose. Well, I have the EP here. David Jones is dead, isn't he? I thought he was Davy.
Davy Jones. Davey? Well, you know, there are a lot of David Joneses.
Oh, it's true. Are we not talking about Davy Jones? Is it Davy Jones from the Monkees, right?
There's Davy Jones from the Monkees, and that's David Bowie's real name, too.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And he changed his name to David Bowie to differentiate himself from Davy Jones of the Monkees.
That's hilarious.
Fame. So,
well, you got me.
Yeah, you know, it's not specifically about any of them. It's just kind of, you know, a rock and roll sort of character, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we just lost Sinead O'Connor. That's another one. That's a freedom fighter and a truth seeker.
Absolutely. We just did a cover of Nothing Compares to You at our show the other night.
I listened to that record. We'll get to the song, but I listened to that record, Become What You Are Not, just the day after, and I forgot, like, how I knew every single song on that record.
Yeah, it's really
every awesome. Song. And I never owned it. I just know that maybe I did and I don't remember. But when that record came out, that was like pretty formative for me about what music can be.
Yeah, yeah. It really, it's a cool record. It goes so many places, you know. I mean, there's obviously a song that everybody remembers is Nothing Compares to You, but there's a lot of colors on that.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, it's really a neat record, and she was really, you know, really something.
Yeah. One might say that her, like, style, like, she was a vocal stylist, you know, right, not specifically going out and writing hooks, but I will argue the fact that if Sinead O'Connor had not put records out, I don't think we would be getting Bjork's or Sugar Cubes or that type of stuff wouldn't be rising to the top. That sort of like stylistic approach to music rather than specifically trying to write hooks, you know?
Yeah, I mean, even like, you know, you're like Alanis Morissette's and stuff that came a few years later, I hear a lot of Sinead, just that her, you know, the power and the wildness in her voice, I think, was like really influential.
Totally.
Well, and she didn't give a fuck.
No, she did not.
She was so awesome.
She did not care. And no, she gave no fucks. And she was, you know, she's one of those people you're like, man, I wonder if I would have liked this person if I would have met her in person. You know what I mean? I wonder if this, would she be too angry or, you know what I mean, or not? Or is this just a facade? Yeah. You start thinking about, well, yeah, I always say don't meet your idols. But I also hear, like, speaking of David Jones, that David Bowie was the nicest man on earth.
I would love to believe that. I choose to believe that that's true, and that's what I've read as well.
I know that, not firsthand, because I haven't never met David Bowie, but my friend Dave Reese, who used to play drums in SNFU, he worked for Bad Religion, and Bad Religion somehow ran into David Bowie, and he was like, hey, how you doing? I'm David Bowie. He's like introducing himself as David Bowie. I'm like, of course you are. You are David Bowie. Yes, you are. There you are.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, you know, David Bowie he seemed, from, you know, an outsider fan kind of perspective, is just like the consummate sort of music lover. You know, he was always covering other people's songs on his records. You know, he had a Pixies song on one of his kind of latter period records. You know, he would just do that. You know, he wasn't like, you know, he just seemed to always be getting into new music, and he didn't have I'm the elder statesman kind of sort of mentality, you know? So I think that was kind of cool.
Did you end up seeing, it was on Star, it was called, well, maybe it wasn't Star down there, but it was called, it was the Pistol, the little bio series on Sex Pistols.
I didn't watch that. No. I was aware of that, but I didn't get around to watching it.
It is really good. Cause they start, it's based on the, was it Filth and the Fury? The book that came out. And they basically follow that narrative from the book, and they talk about breaking in, like, you know, breaking into Hammersmith and stealing David Bowie's mic.
Yeah,
and he owned. I might be wrong on this, but I felt like that white Gibson Les Paul he had was like Mott the Hoople's or something. Like somehow he got that. Like,
I think I heard an interview with Steve Jones where he mentioned that
another Jones.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Out there, yeah.
Well, let's hear David Jones is Dead, and we can come back here. Sorry, I got a page.
Cool. Give me
tell me, does it hurt you too? Maybe you
There's no mention of Matthew Sweet on this, like a Matthew Sweet influence, because I do hear a lot of like 100% Fun, Blue Sky and Mars, that era of Matthew Sweet where.
Yeah, I'm a huge Matthew Sweet fan. I think he is a criminally underrated songwriter from that era. I don't know. Yeah, I was just talking about this to a friend the other day. I don't, you know, he's never seems to be mentioned in the same breath as, like, you know, the Lemonheads or Teenage Fan Club or these other big kind of 90s power pop bands. And to me, you know, I mean, he's the man.
And also very, I've heard him on a podcast too, and he's just nice guy.
Yeah.
Very humble.
Yeah. I think he's a great songwriter, great lyricist, just puts melodies together in this, in a really, really appealing way. And, you know, he has so many records after the ones in the 90s that most people know. I mean, he's still putting out records and they're great, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he never stopped. And some of the ones that are a little more sort of underground, some of his ones from the early '80s and stuff are really, really fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, there's that late 80s Matthew Sweet, which is kind of like, here's what we want you to be, Matthew Sweet. And he was like, and then he did Girlfriend. And Girlfriend is like up there with like, I mean, there was an era of that type of music that Lenny Kravitz was doing, and it seemed that Matthew Sweet, and there was sort of like this genre of 60s kind of influenced pop that just took over in that time. And then it was sort of all intermixed in with the whole Nirvanas and then the Green Days and stuff, but it had its place, you know what I mean? Like, it was this cool little, like, this is the vibey version of what we're listening to in the era. I'm not sure how old you are, but I remember I was 20 years old when that Girlfriend record came out, and it's a great album.
Right. I'm 39. Yeah. And so I was coming of age in the 100% Fun days. And I can remember seeing the video for We're the Same in the middle of the night on MTV.
Yeah.
And I serendipitously found that CD in the used bin at my local Tower Records. And, you know,
I love how that album got its name, because Altered Beast was like, it's a downer. Like, it's a super downer record. And then they go, well, you know, what are you going to give us this time? He goes, oh, it's going to be 100% Fun. And that's how that's how he got the name for the record. And then Blue Sky Mars, there was that sort of era too. Who was he working with as a producer? Brendan O'Brien. Yeah. And that was like, apparently not a nice guy from what I hear. Brendan O'Brien.
Oh.
Bit of a dick. Because there's a Tommy Stinson story, I think, that he was working with Brendan O'Brien. I guess they didn't get along. I think Brendan got fired on a Tommy Stinson record, I think. I don't know.
Brendan O'Brien did the Pearl Jam records too, right? Were those his big ones?
And he did Soundgarden, the Black Hole Sun, the one with on the
Super Unknown.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, he was one of the heavies of the time.
Yeah, for sure. And sort of, I mean, it's interesting because, yeah, you would have been 10 or 11 kind of around when all that 90s Nirvana and all the indie grunge and stuff like that kind of hit. So do you have any older siblings?
No.
Just cool parents?
Just cool parents. Yeah, I'm the oldest of two. My parents were, you know, super into music. Lots of Tom Petty and Eagles and, you know, lots of classic rock stuff that I still love. Beatles, Elton John, Queen, Bowie. That was all the early stuff. And I was, you know, into music when I was really, really young, and they never, you know, had any qualms about me watching MTV or anything. So, you know, I remember being a little kid. I still remember the first time I saw Nirvana on MTV. I think it was, you know, right when Smells Like Teen Spirit was blowing up in 1990. And I was, you know, 8 years old or something, and I called my mom into the room because I wanted to freak her out. I was like, check this out, like, this is what I'm into. And she was like, this is great.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
I was like, oh, I can't freak mom out.
I remember I have a similar story, but with Iron Maiden. I got Number of the Beast by Iron Maiden, and I'm playing it, and it's got like, oh, you know, it's got the whole, oh, you know, earth and sea. My mom is like, my mom's not very religious, but my mom definitely got that passage of the Bible out and said, hey, this is where this is from. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, cool. You know, and it's funny. Who's your favorite Beatle? Because I've gone through all of them at one point in my life. Like, who right now is your favorite Beatle?
I think I've gone through all of them at one point in my life or another, but I'm on a big Paul kick these days, especially since the Peter Jackson doc. I just like became so obsessed with Paul McCartney specifically, and finally did a deep dive into Wings and his solo stuff, and then actually got a chance to see him on his tour last year when he came through Oakland.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul's the man.
We got Disney Plus for Get Back, so we could watch Get Back. And then when he's writing Get Back on camera, it was like, it might as well have been the greatest football play on earth, because I'm standing up and I'm yelling at the TV and I'm yelling at my family like, this is history. You're watching history, and I'm freaking out. Yeah. And there's not a lot of moments in my life where I've actually risen up from the couch and just sort of gone, yes, look at that, you know? And never forget that moment. My family's looking at me like, what the fuck is your problem?
This is so boring. You're like, you don't
know. I know it's 8 hours long.
I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't shut up about that documentary for months afterwards. I think my friends were getting irritated with
it. Yeah. Did you watch it twice? I watched it twice.
I haven't been up for the emotional journey again, to be honest. It really fucked me up in so many ways. I mean, it was really inspiring, but it was just, you know, it was almost like, I remember I was always like, I loved the Beatles so much that when I was young, that for years I was really hesitant to dive into their solo, you know, the post-Beatles stuff. I almost like didn't want to know, you know. And I can remember one night I threw on, this was the first sort of post-Beatles record I got into, I threw on the Plastic Ono Band, John Lennon Plastic Ono Band record. And I like wasn't prepared for it to be so good, and I had to like turn it off. I was like getting emotional. I was like, whoa. I was just trying to throw on some music. Like, I got to turn this record off and put it on when I'm like ready to really digest this thing, and which I later did. But the doc is kind of like that. It's like, I can't just throw it on, you know, cause it's just too intense seeing these guys do that and make that music, and, you know,
effortlessly. You know, in what, two or three weeks, they wrote that, they did that record. That was the way it was done. Like, hey, I have a song, you know, and there is something to be said about with all those cameras on and sort of being under scrutiny, how terrible it must have been. But then it must be also super inspiring, because you're like, well, all these people are waiting for us to write this great record we got here. We don't have it, but we're going to get there. That's an incredible amount of confidence. And also, by the way, 28 years old.
Yeah.
I know. It's started buying my own house at that point. You know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't know what I mean? Like, you'd be, you know, it's just the whole way of doing it. Yeah. It was a fantastic, and also a benefit from the P word too, because it was only supposed to be 2.5 hours long. And then when they realized, oh, we're not going to theatrically release this, then they opened up the whole vault and completely went ham on the thing.
That I did not know.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, because I remember they was talking about promoting it. Like, so we've got this, here's part of it. And he presses play, Peter Jackson's doing it. And then they go, and then what he said later on is like, but we have the time. We can just really make it breathe, you know?
Yeah. I'm glad. I mean, what a gift, right? To be able to be a fly on the wall. You know, the craziest thing about the whole thing, the Beatles were so good. You know, they never even intended to release that record at first, you know. Yeah. They went in and they recorded Across the Universe and The Long and Winding Road and Let It Be, for God's sake, and then they were like, let's not release that. Let's make a different record.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They were just, you know, just to have that many good songs in them, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, and then John Lennon's like ripping on George Harrison for I Me Mine. And it's like, what? It just means they're human, right? Like, they're human, and like, we're a rock band. That's all we do, is rock band stuff. It's like, no. You guys did Sgt. Pepper's. Like, you're not just a rock band, you know?
Yeah.
But you imagine how incredibly frustrating that would be? Like, the genius of George Harrison's always under the shadow of Paul and John, also outnumbered, because Ringo's just sitting back smoking cigarettes all night. He has no opinion. He's like, I just like to play drums.
And he's ready to nail it, though, as soon as the count goes off. You know? I got a whole new appreciation for... I mean, Ringo Starr's always been my favorite drummer anyway, but especially after watching that documentary, the band, John and Paul, are kind of fucking around a lot, and they'd be halfway through a good take and then start doing a silly voice and ruin it or something.
Yeah.
Ringo is just holding it down the whole time.
Yeah.
He's ready to go. And the rooftop performance, I mean, just his drum performance alone. I mean, you're talking like all time powerhouse drum performances.
Yeah.
Ringo on that rooftop.
My buddy and I did because he does a podcast on Bruce Springsteen. But we also did a co-release of a podcast on the Just Watching Get Back and talking about it. And the funniest part of that rooftop is that he's got his roadie holding the music, where the roadie said later on, it's like, there was a bunch of music stands like in the studio, like four floors down. I could have just brought a music stand up and plopped it there. But the urgency where he's like, hold the music. So he's actually holding the book open so John could read the lyrics. It's like,
wow,
what the hell? Like, yeah, it's great. And when the cops are trying to get in, they put a hidden camera in and all that stuff. Like, there was some thought put into that. And
yeah,
that lady, whatever her name is, the secretary, she's the star of that movie because she held that guy back from like shutting the whole thing down.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Man, we're gonna waste half this time talking about the Beatles.
Hey, I could go on.
That's awesome. Well, let's hear. I like this the Dear Angeline song. So let's play that song now.
And, I play in a band we hardly ever play, but I play in a band called The Revolts with Spike from Spike from Revolts.
I've had Spike on the show like two or three times.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we, you know, we're like a once a year type of type of, but yeah. And, you know, I mean, I love a lot of that music. I mean, Bad Religion, you know, I play the band, but
yeah.
I still follow them. I still follow them to this day. When they make a new record, you know, I'm listening to it on the day it comes out. You know, I love that band.
Yeah. I had Spike on in my car playing ukulele, and we drove around Toronto while he was singing like Xanadu.
Oh.
And he did Alone Again Naturally. And there's a third one, but I didn't actually get it. Like I have it. I just don't have it. I don't know where it is. I don't know if you can see all these hard drives here, but it's in here somewhere. But yeah. Spike and I drove around Toronto, and we almost hit a runner. He's playing away, and you can like, whoa, shit. And I came around a corner, and this fucking runner, you could kind of see it in the frame. This scoots across right in front of me. And, and he's laughing like, oh my God, we almost hit a person.
Yeah. I remember that video. I didn't know that was you.
Yeah. Yeah. That was me. Oh man. That was 2017 now. It feels like
a
long time ago, but, have you ever been up this way to Canadian lands to play?
I've played in Vancouver a few times with various bands. I was in a band called Warm Soda, and we played up there several times. But you're
in Toronto.
You're on the East Coast. You're on the East side.
I'm three time zones away from you. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I've never been over there. Now I've just been up to Vancouver several times.
That's a kind of a cool drive too. I mean, I've done that drive a few times with bands that I played throughout the 90s, and it's a fun, like, I mean, just coming down through Eugene and, you know, Seattle, Portland, Eugene, and then somehow you end up in Sacramento. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem to be
stretch of what's going on. Where are we in between Eugene and
a lot of roads and a lot of, weed. I know Weed, California is there, 'cause we laugh our asses off when you drive by it. We put a sticker on the weed sign, 'cause that's important. That's what you gotta do.
Yep. You got to get your coffee mug.
Yeah. Obviously they're not unaware of how funny that is to have a, you know.
Oh, especially nowadays, you know, they lean into it.
Are you going to be taking this on the road? Is just a project to stop you from being crazy in the gaming industry? Like, what's your...
It's certainly a project to stop me from being crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'd like to take it on the road. You know, I mean, it's so new still. You know, we played a small handful of shows, four or five. So we're really just kind of getting it off the ground. But we'd like to start doing some regional stuff here in the U.S. And certainly some overseas stuff. We're kind of got a couple things sort of brewing for maybe next year sometime. Hopefully after the full length is out. We're trying to get the full length out first and then see if we can cobble together something in Europe.
Europe's the bomb, man. It's the place to go.
After I toured Europe, I kind of was sort of scratching my head over why I bothered to tour the United States anymore.
Me too.
It's so much rougher over here than it is over there.
It's like America and Canada is like one big UK. It's like one big England. And as soon as you get across that into Point Calais, and then you start get through France and get to Germany, life is beautiful. And I have I have a few reasons I understand why. I kind of know why. I just don't know the real reason. My theory is that it's just because they're trying to give something for the young people to do.
Yeah, I know at least in the Netherlands, and I think in many other countries I've heard, you know, the arts are subsidized, are state subsidized, right? So,
So is Canada. Yeah. Like Canada as well. Like we have Canadian content, we have a bunch of grants you can sign up for, Canadian Arts Grant Council and all whatever it is. But it's different. It's different in Europe.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, my experience of touring Europe was so good and just, you know, people of all kinds of different stripes kind of showing up to the shows, not just kind of scene folks, you know what I mean? It was just seemed to be a, you know, in general, a less sort of clicky. I mean, I'm generalizing beyond what makes sense, obviously, because we're talking about a ton of different countries, and they're all they're all different and unique. But just in comparison to my experience in the United States and the UK, really, I mean, it's just feels different. It feels different in a good way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going across as a 30-year-old person, which in North America, you're done. You know what I mean? There's no give up. Yeah. You're done. Go get your job at the bank, you know, old man. Yeah. Europe didn't seem to care. And we released four records over there on three different record labels. We toured across there 5 times. People were like into it. And it's like, well, what is the missing equation here? Why isn't it? And what we figured out, maybe what it possibly is the fact there was no real music-driven TV. There was no image-based media.
Oh, interesting.
That was what we thought. But it could be wrong. It could be wrong. But there was also, like, you know what I mean? Because it's like they didn't care what you looked like. And then there were the other one. My joke is because, well, look, they have the Scorpions. Look at them. You know what I mean? Like, they're massive.
They do love the Scorpions. If there's one generalization you could make about Europe.
They love the Scorpions. Yeah, they're playing the Ginorma Dome somewhere like tonight, I bet you, at one point. Oh, yeah. There's also a band that goes over from Canada called Saga, which are like a prog rock band from the 80s. And my buddy is their sound guy, front of house sound guy. And he shows me these postings on Facebook. It's like, they're playing in front of like 5,000 people. I'm like, what is going on with Europe?
That's the dream, man. They figured something out.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other one is like, because it felt like that there was. And the other one is that they didn't have like, they had 1,000 more years of culture than we did. That's maybe genetically, there's a genetic advantage. You play in a building that's 800 years old. I mean, that's gotta somehow wear off on you.
Right. Right. Maybe. Yeah. There's definitely a vibe and an appreciation. That you don't, again, I'm generalizing, feel so much in the United States, where there are great scenes in a lot of great cities, but you know, things tend to be very, very, things are just sort of clicky and, you know, it could be a media saturation thing. I don't know, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the other fact is like, they feel, you've traveled 4,000 miles to come and play here. Yes. We're going to show up. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we're going to show up. You know, and the flip side of it, in Toronto, there's a place called the Bovine. And the band, my band at the time opened up for this French band, and nobody came. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? These people flew on planes, and they rented gear to play in this venue. Where is everybody? You know?
That's a classic. That's a classic San Francisco move, is as soon as the touring band comes on, the room clears.
Yeah. Brutal. Yeah, San Francisco, bottom of the hill. I saw a band called Babe the Blue Ox there, and I'll never forget that show. It was like one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in my life, Bottom of the Hill Club.
San Francisco. It's one of the great venues.
Is it still open? Still open?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just saw the Reverend Horton Heat there a couple
times. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was this amazing thing. Like, we just sort of walked in. It was like, someone knew what it was. So this is like 1993 or 2 or something. Like, sort of show up, and I saw that this band Babe the Blue Ox play, and they're like the greatest, just this weird band that I've always loved, and they're just this three piece, and I ended up seeing again. They opened up for Sean Lennon, Sibo Matu. I saw
I know that band.
And I saw them open for that. So somehow I just trading letters with the bass player from Babe the Blue Ox, and next thing you know it, I'm like, hey, I'm here. I came knocking the door. Like, can we come see the show? And they got us on the guest list. And
Oh, cool.
Babe the Blue Ox, man. Check them out. They're a great band.
I feel like I've heard that name, but I don't know. I can't think of their music offhand.
Yeah, they don't. Their Spotify is weird because it's every song they ever wrote, but alphabetical. So it's really tough to sort of navigate your way through their music because, the music, the song that starts with a number is the first song, but it might be their last song in their repertoire. Like, I think they were on, they were on RCA Records for like a very, very hot minute in the sort of the mid-90s when people were trying to fill that void of the empty hole of the Green Days and the Offsprings and the Nirvanas.
Right, when major labels were snapping up
whoever
they could get their hands on and putting them in weird, like, slavery contracts and things where,
What's even worse now, man, It is way worse now. I don't know if you know, you like they call it what's it called, the full circle deal, where it's like they get part of your merch.
Like, oh, I've heard of this. Yeah.
No thanks. Or is it 360 deal? Whatever they call it, it is a deal.
Racket. I've heard about that. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. Anyways,
they got to buy their Maseratis. You know. Whoa.
That's right.
What would be me if they couldn't buy their.
Major labels are making more money now than they ever did. They don't need to make CDs. Vinyl they sell, they can sell for like mark it up by four times. Like,
right.
And it's usually a re-release of some Whitney Houston or something, you know, record. It's like, it's already paid for. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't even need to pay for the recording.
Yeah, man. You got a few minutes here. Let's listen to, we might get through this whole record.
It's short. I think we can do it.
Yeah. This is I'm Not the Only One. There's this great record, I forget what it's called, but I think it was re-recorded by Steve Albini.
It was In Color.
Yeah, In Color. Yeah. Was it a re-recording or was it an actual recording?
It was a re-recording. I got a bootleg of that once, and it's really interesting. I mean, it sounds like a Steve Albini record for sure, but it's Cheap Trick redoing In Color. I guess they weren't, I heard the legend was they were never happy with how, I don't know who produced that record, but they thought that the producer kind of rounded the edges off a little too much. And so they were never happy with how that record sounded. I think that record sounds great, but I also think it is a very sort of pop forward kind of representation of them when right after that they do Live at Budokan, which is this huge rock thing. I think that's probably how they saw themselves a little more.
Yeah. Oh, the dawn of the live album too. Like maybe not as live as you'd think, but like Jackson Brown put a live album around the same time. Cheap Trick live at Budokan. Kiss alive, not live.
Right.
All that sort of era. Oh, Peter Frampton comes alive. Like where they're outselling themselves. They're outselling themselves on live albums for some reason.
But, and Neil Young, Russ Never Sleeps was around then too, which is mostly live, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just seemed like that was the thing, like, hey, we can make more money if we do a live version of it. And it's weird like how infectious live music is. Maybe it was the technology caught up and people hear people cheering and it's like, no, it sounds live, it's close, right? Like our brains are a little bit more developed now where we're not gonna get fooled by the Elton John, Benny and the Jets fake.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I guess there's some debate as to how much of those live albums is really live, but
yeah. What was it? The Eagles. The Eagles. Did you see the Eagles documentary where they're talking about their live album? And he said the only touring we did on that record is sending the 2-inch masters from studio to studio. That's a great documentary, by the way. It's called When Hell Freezes Over. It is fantastic. Amazing. And I think after Glenn Frey died, they actually made like another hour. They added an hour onto it. So it's like 3 hours plus. And there's like talking about the long run where, I mean, if you're an Eagles fan, they're talking about recording and they're doing long run and Don Henley's playing drums and singing and it sounds exactly like the record. So he's singing and playing drums. I'm like, that's such a, and then stopping. I'm like, hold on. He must be playing to the track. I'm like, no, they're actually recording that. The long run, you know?
Yeah, that's their, you know, I mean, geez, the level of talent in that band is just off the charts. I know, I always feel like they get kind of unfairly, you know, sort of maligned. I grew up on the Eagles, so I love that music.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know who else is sort of Bay Area? You're going to laugh. Huey Lewis and the News, man.
Oh, Huey Lewis and the News. Yeah, great. Great band. Yeah.
I have a very quick story I'll tell you. The first concert I ever real saw was Huey Lewis and the News. I saw Supertramp and I saw Rush and then I saw Huey Lewis and the News unchaperoned. And I saw it like on the grass at this or on this little venue at a fun park. And I loved and loved that show. It's like, this is the first time I've seen, this is what a live show is. And so I'm sitting and talking with my buddy who we play in a band called the Fairmounts, and he's the guy that does Mikey and his uke. Have you ever seen the guy, the ukulele, like all the punk rock covers and check it out. But he had Tony Hawk singing songs on his thing. We're having like a Skype conversation, gives you an idea how long ago it was. And he's wearing a Huey Lewis and a News shirt. And I tell him the story. I'm like, that's one of the first concerts. What we should do is we should cover the sports album front to back. Let's do that. You know, he goes, haha, that'd be great. And then 2 weeks later, he goes, like, I've learned all the drum parts. 10 years go by, and we put a band together, like pre-pandemic, and we put this band together. We did the sports album front to back, and we do it now. We have all these guys. Like, we have a real horn player, and a guy plays keyboards. And
oh, man, that's great.
It's so much fun playing music.
With a big ensemble like that, too.
And it's fun playing music that people have heard before.
Yeah. I've recently come around to the idea of, you know, including it's not like I've not wanted to play other people's songs, but I've just never been the type who learned a lot of other people's music. And now, well, you know, we're a new band. We don't have that many songs, so we got to throw some stuff in. But you know, it is nice to play something that people really, really know.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, you know, doing it, like, this is the first business license I've ever owned, you know what I mean, where we do, because you play, like, public events and for, like, municipalities and, you know, rib fests and things. I don't know if you have rib fests there, that type of stuff. Yeah. And they need a tax number. So it's like, this is the first time I've ever charged tax to play music. It's very, very weird, but also very grown up.
A former bandmate of mine is in a local band here called Fleetwood Macrame, who's a Fleetwood Mac cover band, and they just sold out the Great American Music Hall the other day. I mean, they're huge in the Bay Area. Like, this guy's got something figured out, man.
Yeah.
And they're great. I mean, you know, the level of talent it takes to pull off that music at the level that they are is, you know,
There's a band up here called the Dwayne Gretzky's, and they the same thing. They play, they sell out like 2,000 capacity venues, and they're basically just this awesome wedding band.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's the way, you know, things are, man. I mean, there's a lot of the venues downtown in Toronto are like, they're doing indie night and then they'll do cover night. And yeah. I'll tell you, the purists are a little bit pissed off about that.
Yeah. As long as people are enjoying live music, right? I mean, you know, yeah, most people want to go see, you know, somebody turn up and play Go Your Own Way. You know, they don't want to, you know, that's always going to have a bigger audience than whatever, you know, song I write or whatever. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about, I mean, Fleetwood Mac, that's an also a very cool, if you saw that part of the Sound City documentary where they're talking about making that record the guy producing it, he's speaking to, I think it was the bass player. And he goes, you know, it's not really close to our sound. He goes, yeah, but it's a lot closer to the bank.
Yeah.
Which is very true.
Yeah. Very true. Yeah.
Well, we got one more song. Let's hear it. It's called Hear Me. Okay. It's the digital bonus track.
This is the one that couldn't fit on the record.
Oh, okay, okay. Now, before we start, so is it like a, not a 33 and a half, like full, is it a maxi, yeah, whatever they call it?
Yeah. It's a 7-inch 45, and we technically could have fit four songs, but the quality gets really, really questionable if the program material is too long.
Yeah.
And so we just figured, you know, most people sort of consume things digitally nowadays anyway. If they want the record, it's kind of as an artifact.
Yeah.
It's cool when people put it on the turntable and listen to it too, but you know, it is whatever year it is, 2023. Mm-hmm. And most people are, you know,
that is an interesting, it's funny you say that, because that is true. You'll buy your record and then you get the download code. And 99.9% of the time, the record's on the thing because it's something you own and it's yours and that's something you have. It's a physical item. But the enjoyment, the consumption of it, you're not going to have a record player in your car. This isn't 1955, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to listen to, or you're going to go for a walk in the park, or you're going to bike ride, or, you know, this is how you consume music now.
Yeah, you're not gathering around the turntable and sitting and putting on a. I mean, we should, and I'm sure many still do, but that's not the predominant mode of music consumption nowadays.
I've been in a few guys' basements, their man caves. I was working on this one thing, and I interviewed two people, kind of like high up in the music industry. Both of them had their own listening spot, mm-hmm. and what it was is a couch. Like the Memorex commercial.
Yeah.
And a table and an ashtray or whatever for whatever. Yeah. And then these massive big speakers and then like a record player that you'd get up and put the record on. And I'm like, that's two people that were sort of high up. That's still a way to do it. Because it's like one of those things, like there's not a lot of entertaining happening in this basement. Like I'm down here entertaining myself. There's one spot to sit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, it is a beautiful thing when you find the time to put down a record or to put on a record and just sit and listen to it. But
totally. Well, let's hear it. Hear me.
Yeah.
we were talking about the Weaker Thans. Somebody went and took their website because the website ran out, and then someone got their domain, weakerthans.com. So they were like, well, what do we do? So they just went weakerthans.org. Then that's they got around it.
So yeah, someone tried to hold the .com hostage.
Yeah. And they're like, we're not paying you for that. Yeah.
Nice try, but
I met a guy years ago in Buffalo who was like the dawn of the internet who bought Pepsi. He had the Pepsi domain.
In
like 1995 or 6 or something around there. I'm like, man, you're going to make so much money off that.
that's some vision right there.
Absolutely.
To snap that one up quick.
Totally. Yeah.
We should all have such foresight.
Right. Well, Rob, this has been an absolute pleasure. We're almost up to our hour of time here. I appreciate your effort in this and coming in on time. You know, that's always showing up on time.
I'm nothing if not prompt and professional, I guess.
Appreciate that.
I really appreciate you having me. This was a lot of fun. You're a cool guy. You're doing cool stuff.
Thanks, man.
It was really nice chatting with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And whenever you do that full length, you just get in touch with me and we'll make that happen.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. We'll go track for track on that one. We'll have to set aside a little more time.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe a two-parter.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Awesome. I can talk about the Beatles for 2 hours.
Yes, well, we got there, and I appreciate it, man. Thanks for doing it. I appreciate it. Cool.
Thank you.
And that was Rob Good from The Goods. Go check out the link will be in the description to go see the video for David Jones is Dead. It's cool. And the album is on Dandy Boy Records, and you can go to Bandcamp and go find them there and go get all that stuff. It came out in July. It came out a month ago. So I'm really late. I'm trying to get these episodes up and get these interviews done because I'm just a one-man show. I do 20 other things in this life, and podcast is part of it, but my God, there's a lot of stuff to do these days. My episode been selling my documentary, the live venues and going to places, and a lot of stuff going on. My new job is busy. It's the busiest summer I've ever had in my career. So anyways, thank you so much for tuning in. That's enough about me. I hope to see you next week when we have another episode of the Apple Up Podcast. And thank you so much for tuning in every week. And if you're getting to the end of this ramble, thank you so much. I appreciate it. That's you, Mom. Okay, I'll see you all